Numbers chapter 15, the fifth talk in a series on the narrative portions of Numbers, was presented by David Crabtree on November 21, 2004 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc. 2004. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved.
2 weeks ago, we went through chapters 13 and 14, in which the children of Israel made their way to the southern part of the Promised Land, making their way across the desert from Egypt, God leading the way. And it was time to go into the Promised Land. God told them to go into the Promised Land, and they were too afraid. They wouldn't do it. And God reprimanded them for that. And then they decided, well, we will go in. And God said, no, don't. And they said, no, we will. We want to do what you said to do. We want the land. They went in, and they were beat up badly by the Canaanites. So God said that he was going to have them go back into the wilderness, and they would spend time in the wilderness until that whole generation had died off, except for the two spies that had gone into the land and had encouraged the Israelites to do what God had said, that they could take the land. And that was Caleb and Joshua. So, starting in chapter 15 then, in Numbers, it's talking about this 40-year period, but all we have of this 40-year period is about three or four chapters. There just isn't much information about that span of time. God, in what he had inspired and written down as the Old Testament, doesn't pay much attention to those 40 years. To the extent that we do have record of the 40 years, it would appear that they weren't on the move all of the time. At the end of Numbers, it recounts the various places that they stopped on their whole trip from Egypt to the Promised Land. Only about a dozen places are listed as places that they stopped during these 40 years. So they must have stayed for long periods of time at some of those camps where they stayed. So they were not apparently moving around constantly, which is what I know I thought earlier when I was younger, that this was a constant movement, but that doesn't seem to be the case. They settled in at camps for a period of time, possibly even years, and then move on to another one. One of the places that they stayed for an extended period of time was apparently Kadesh Barnea, which is where they had stopped before they went before God asked them to go into the Promised Land the first time. Now, I've mentioned before that Numbers is a mixture of historical narrative and laws interspersed into the narrative text. And as you'll recall, I skipped the first 10 chapters of Numbers because it was primarily laws. Chapter 15 is more laws. And I thought about skipping 15, but I decided I wouldn't. I'm going to venture into some legislation here, which is a challenge. But one of the questions that, the reason I didn't skip it is because it's here. Whoever wrote Numbers, and I'll assume that it's Moses, had some plan in mind. There's some reason why the pieces that are in here are in here. And there's some reason why these laws are included here. And I think if we are to get the impact of what was intended by Moses, it would be better not to skip them because they are here. Furthermore, I am working on a project. It's a long-term project, but I think it's an important project. I think it is important, in order to understand the New Testament well, to understand the Old Testament well. And a big part of the Old Testament is the legislation. The laws that were given to the people of Israel to follow. And it creates a culture. Those laws create a culture. And that culture becomes a part of the people of Israel. It informs the way that they look at the world. And I think, therefore, it's important for us to, as much as possible, reconstruct in our minds the kind of experience on a day-to-day basis that the people of Israel had. All of the sights and the sounds and the smells and the tastes are all part of that picture, and I think it's good to reconstruct that. So we'll look at a few laws here that will help us just slightly to get a better understanding of their daily life and how God chose to instruct them about Him through the legislation that He gave to them. As we go through these laws, one of the commentaries that I used called this a miscellaneous assortment of laws. That could be, it may be just a miscellaneous assortment of laws. But it seems to me that it is at least prudent to consider the possibility that there is coherence to the laws, that there's a reason why all of these laws are grouped together in this particular chapter. And in order to understand that, it's helpful to understand the structure of the chapter. And it seems to me that the best way to see the structure is we have three times where the text says that the Lord spoke to Moses. So I think there are three main parts to this chapter. Two of them begin with the phrase, when you enter into the land. So two of them are talking towards the future. That is, this is legislation that's in preparation for them going into the land. The other one does not start out with that. And those that begin with, when you enter into the land, seem to be laws or adjustments to the laws that they've already been given that take into account the fact that they are going to become a settled agricultural society as opposed to a nomadic desert people. They also seem to reinforce the promise that God has made that they will indeed occupy the land. That's what God has in view. And by saying when you enter into the land, He's reassuring them that that will happen. And furthermore, the laws seem to be predicated on the assumption that they will have plenty. They will have abundance when they get into the land. I'm going to argue that verse 22 is also a division marker, but we'll get to that when we work our way through. All right, the first section, verses 1 through 16. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you enter the land where you are to live, which I am giving you, then make an offering by fire to the Lord, a burnt offering or a sacrifice to fulfill a special vow, or as a freewill offering, or in your appointed times to make a soothing aroma to the Lord, from the herd or from the flock. And the one who presents his offering shall present to the Lord a grain offering of 1/10 of an ephah of fine flour, mixed with 1/4 of a hin of oil, and you shall prepare wine for the libation, 1/4 of a hin, with the burnt offering or for the sacrifice for each lamb. Or for a ram, you shall prepare as a grain offering 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour, mixed with 1/3 of a hin of oil. And for the libation, you shall offer 1/3 of a hin of wine as a soothing aroma to the Lord. And when you prepare a bull as a burnt offering or a sacrifice to fulfill a special vow or for peace offerings to the Lord, then you shall offer with the bull a grain offering of 3/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with 1/2 a hin of oil. And you shall offer as the libation one half a hin of wine as an offering by fire, as a soothing aroma to the Lord. Thus it shall be done for each ox, or for each ram, or for each of the male lambs, or of the goats. According to the number that you prepare, so you shall do for everyone according to their number. All who are native shall do these things in this manner, in presenting an offering by fire as a soothing aroma to the Lord. And if an alien sojourns with you, or one who may be among you throughout your generations, and he wishes to make an offering by fire as a soothing aroma to the Lord, just as you do, so he shall do. As for the assembly, there shall be one statute for you and for the alien who sojourns with you, a perpetual statute throughout your generations. As you are, so shall the alien be before the Lord. There is to be one law and one ordinance for you and for the alien who sojourns with you. This section is talking about sacrifices, offerings that are made. And there are two kinds of offerings that it's talking about. One is the Holocaust, which is the whole burnt offering. And the other is, what are they called? Free will offerings or peace offerings. Now, the whole burnt offering is an offering that was commanded for the people of Israel to provide on certain occasions, on the holidays, at least one, oftentimes more than one, and on other certain occasions. This offering was by far the most common offering given in the life of Israel. And the way that it was done is that the individual would bring the sacrificial animal to the temple when there was a temple. Now in the wilderness, they would be bringing it to the tabernacle. And the individual brings it right up to the altar, just north of the altar. And the sacrificial animal, what kind of animal, is dependent on the person's wealth. The more wealthy, the more expensive the animal that is required to be provided. They bring the animal to just north of the altar. They place their hand on the head of the animal. And then the one bringing the offering actually kills the animal, cuts its throat. Priests then collect the blood, and blood is sprinkled on the altar. And then the priest cuts the animal up and arranges it on the altar. And then the animal is burned completely. That is the Holocaust, the whole burnt offering. And the significance of this offering is it's a statement on the part of the offerer that the offerer is saying, I am dedicated and devoted to God. There is an identity between me and God. And this sacrifice is a statement of that commitment and devotion. The peace offering is similar. Again, the offerer brings the animal, but brings it only to the entryway into the temple. And then the offerer again puts his hand on the head of the animal, cuts the throat of the animal. Blood is collected and sprinkled on the altar by the priests. But in this kind of offering, the animal is cut up, but only a portion of it is burned on the altar. The internal organs are all put on the altar and burned, but the meat itself is divided. Part of it goes to the priests who eat it, and the rest of it is consumed by the offerer and his household in the temple precinct. This particular offering is done only at the initiative of the offerer. That is, if the offerer has made a vow, then in completion of the vow, he gives a free will offering. Or if the offerer just wants to do it, he gives a free will offering. So this kind is always at the initiative of the giver. It's not to fulfill any requirement that has not been initiated by the giver himself. What is happening here, these two kinds of offerings are prescribed in Exodus at Mount Sinai. God prescribed these and made arrangements for these and how they were to be done. What is being said here is not new in that respect. The only thing that is new is God is requiring that with the animal be included a flour and oil mixture that also is apparently burnt on the altar, and that wine be poured out. And it's not clear whether it's poured out on the sacrificial animal or whether it's poured at the base of the altar. There's indications that both happened. In any case, what God is doing here is including more that is to be given with each of these kinds of offering. And what is to be given is produce from the land. It is things that would be produced by an agricultural society. And seems to be filling out, sometimes these offerings are called the table of the Lord. They seem to be filling out the meal that is offered to God. So the new part is these other components of the offerings that are to be given. And the amount of wine and the amount of oil and the amount of flour goes up with the value of the animal. The bigger the animal, the more of these other components. The other thing that's being added here and made explicit is who is supposed to do this. Previously in Exodus, it had talked about the Israelites being incumbent upon them. But here it stresses that it's not just the Israelites, but it's also the what are called the ger. These are the resident aliens, that is, people who are not descendants of Abraham, but who have officially allied themselves with the people of Israel. They have joined them and become a part of the people. And what's stressed here is anyone who has done that, they take upon themselves the same obligations, and they enjoy the same benefits as an Israelite with respect to these things. And that had not been made explicit previously. The second one, verses 17 through 21. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel, and say to them, when you enter the land where I bring you, then it shall be that when you eat of the food of the land, you shall lift up an offering to the Lord. Of the first of your dough you shall lift up a cake as an offering. As the offering of the threshing floor, so you shall lift it up. From the first of your dough you shall give to the Lord an offering throughout your generations." There is much rabbinic debate about this particular passage. What they are supposed to do when they enter into the land, when they make bread, they are supposed to offer some of the dough to God. And how do they offer it to God? In Jewish tradition, that's done by giving a loaf of bread to the priests. That's the way that that's accomplished. How often is that done? That is hotly debated, but the consensus seems to be that what's required here is every time a batch of dough is made. So when a batch of dough is made, then one loaf of what is baked then goes to the priest. There are some rabbis who argue that this is only true of bread that's made from grain that's produced in Israel, because it says, when you enter in the land where I bring you. But that only becomes an issue much later in Jewish history. Now, the emphasis in this section seems to be on the non-farmer. For the farmer, there is the requirement of a first fruits offering. When the crop first comes on, a portion of the first fruits of that crop are given to God as an offering. This seems to is envisioning a society that's not made up entirely of farmers, because this is a household requirement. Every household is required to give one loaf to God out of the batch of dough that they make. Okay. All right. Now the next section, and I think this is a separate section, starts in 22, and let's see, how far are we going to read? Through 29. But when you unwittingly fail and do not observe all these commandments which the Lord has spoken to Moses, even all that the Lord has commanded you through Moses, from the day when the Lord gave commandment and onward throughout your generations, then it shall be, if it is done unintentionally, without the knowledge of the congregation, that all the congregation shall offer one bull for a burnt offering as a soothing aroma to the Lord, with its grain offering and its libation according to the ordinance, and one male goat for a sin offering. Then the priest shall make atonement for all the congregation of the sons of Israel, and they shall be forgiven, for it was an error. And they have brought their offering, an offering by fire to the Lord, and their sin offering before the Lord for their error. So all the congregation of the sons of Israel will be forgiven, with the alien who sojourns among them, for it happened to all the people through error. Also, if one person sins unintentionally, then he shall offer a one-year-old female goat for a sin offering. And the priest shall make atonement before the Lord for the person who goes astray when he sins unintentionally, making atonement for him that he may be forgiven. You shall have one law for him who does anything unintentionally, for him who is native among the sons of Israel and the alien who sojourns among them. I think what's going on here, and the reason I think this is a new section, is because when the author starts out and says, but when you unwittingly fail and do not observe all these commandments which the Lord has spoken to Moses, I think he's referring to the commandments he's just listed in this chapter. And so it's a continuation from what he's already said. He's just saying if someone fails to follow these unintentionally, then there are some things that need to be done. But then it goes on in 23 and says, even all that the Lord has commanded you through Moses from the day when the Lord commanded and onward throughout your generations. I think here he's saying, well, what I'm going to say doesn't just apply to these commandments just given, but applies more broadly to the commandments that have been given to Moses from God all inclusively. So he didn't intend this to be a completely new section, but started out and then expanded it. And I suspect that's the way I put this together. In any case, what he goes on to talk about is unintentional wrongdoing, violations of the commandments that are done, first of all, by the community. The whole community does something that is inadvertent. It's not an attempt, it's not rebellious in spirit. It's just a violation of what God has commanded. In that case, they are to offer a whole burnt offering, and then they are to offer, and then they offer a sin offering. And the rules that applied before, including the meal and the wine, obviously would be a part of what they are to offer to God. In so doing, the whole community is spared guilt for what they've done. Not only the Israelites, but again, it stresses, but also the foreign aliens that are among them. Then in 27, it talks about individuals that sin inadvertently. And then they are to offer a sacrifice for that, and they will be forgiven completely. And this too applies not just to the Israelites, but it applies to foreign aliens that are among them as well. Verse 30 then begins the other spectrum. Now we're no longer talking about inadvertent, but we're talking about intentional wrongdoing. I'll read 30 and 31. But the person who does anything defiantly, whether he is a native or an alien, that one is blaspheming the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from among his people, because he has despised the word of the Lord and has broken his commandment. That person shall be completely cut off, and his guilt shall be on him. So at the other end of the spectrum is not one who does something inadvertently, but one who does something intentionally, who does something, the way the Hebrew reads, is with a high hand. That's an interesting expression. The Israelites, when they left Egypt, they acted towards Pharaoh, it says, with a high hand. And there it has a positive connotation. They acted towards Pharaoh with a high hand, indicating that they are essentially saying, you are not the boss of me. Here, in this context, to act with a high hand with respect to God would be to say to God, you are not the boss of me. So this is defiance. This is saying, God, you do not have authority over me. I will be my own boss. Anyone who acts that way, it says, is blaspheming the Lord. And then it goes on to say, because he has despised the word of the God, of the Lord, and has broken his commandments. He hasn't taken God and what God says seriously. And what is said is that he shall be cut off from among his people. Now it's not clear what that entails, what it means for someone to be cut off from the people. It seems to mean that this is action that God takes, that God cuts them off, that it's a spiritual kind of thing that occurs when someone acts in this way, rather than something that the people of Israel have to respond to and do something about. And then it concludes by saying, his guilt shall be upon him. In other words, there is no forgiveness for that kind of rebelliousness. He will die with his guilt rather than having that taken away. Verse 32 through 36, I think, is case law that goes with what we've just read. In other words, an example of acting high-handedly. Here's what it says. Now, while the sons of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man gathering wood on the Sabbath day. And those who found him gathering wood brought him to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation. And they put him in custody because it had not been declared what should be done to him. Then the Lord said to Moses, the man shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp. So all the congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him to death with stones, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. So here is an instance. We don't know when this occurred. This could have occurred much earlier, or it could have occurred during these 40 years. It's just not clear. If it is case law that's using to amplify someone, what should be done in the case of someone who acts high-handedly, as I think it is, then we don't know when it occurred. What happened? There was an Israelite who was out gathering firewood on the Sabbath. Nowhere in the law that was given to Moses at Sinai does it say specifically that you cannot collect firewood on the Sabbath. It does say specifically that you can't start a fire on the Sabbath. So it could be that they should have inferred from that that gathering firewood on the Sabbath is wrong. They were told that they were not supposed to collect manna on the Sabbath. It could be that they were to have been able to infer from that that collecting firewood on the Sabbath was wrong. It could be that this man was gathering firewood with the full intention of starting a fire on the Sabbath. And I suspect that it's probably something along those lines. If this is to be case law for what preceded it, we're talking about a high-handed action. We're talking about an activity that is openly rebellious against God. So I suspect that they found this man who was gathering firewood, whose full intention was not just to gather firewood on the Sabbath, but his full intention is to actually start a fire. And that was prohibited. So they took him into custody and they take him to Moses because it says it had not been declared what should be done to him. If someone violates the Sabbath, they will be cut off. But it was not made clear what the people of Israel were supposed to do with respect to that, if anything. Well, God speaks to Moses and says, the man shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp. So he is to be put to death. He's to be put to death by the Israelites. And the way that that's supposed to be done is to take him outside the camp and the people of Israel pick up stones and throw them at the criminal until he is killed. I think that that's a very interesting way to carry out an execution. Because what's happening is the whole community is putting this person to death. It's not one executioner. Who can say which rock was the fatal blow? And it's not one person, but it's the whole group. So it's the community saying by its action that this person is guilty and has violated the laws of God and is not a part of us, ought not be allowed to continue to live. And it's done outside the camp, because in the camp is holy ground. So this case law then is making clear, if a person is cut off and is to be put to death, this is the way that it is to be done with respect to a violation of the Sabbath. Okay, now then the last section, 37 to 41. The Lord also spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and tell them that they shall make for themselves tassels on the corners of their garments throughout their generations, and that they shall put on the tassel of each corner a cord of blue, and it shall be a tassel for you to look at and remember all the commandments of the Lord, so as to do them, and not follow after your own heart and your own eyes, after which you played the harlot, in order that you may remember to do all my commandments and be holy to your God. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord your God. So now they're being told that they're supposed to make these tassels, and the tassels are supposed to go on the corners of their garments, and it's not clear, nobody knows exactly what that means, where the corners of their garments are. But apparently there are suitable places for attachment for these tassels. The tassels are made up of mainly one color, and it doesn't specify what color that would be, but also within those tassels must be strands of blue. Why blue? Blue was a color that was attached to royalty way back in that time, Thus we have the term royal blue even now. Even back in the ancient world, blue was associated with royalty. And the things that belonged to the king or were some sense special to the king oftentimes had blue as an indication of that. So presumably these tassels are ornaments that are attached to their everyday clothes. They wear them every day, that are a reminder that I am God's. And because I am God's, I'm to remember all of the commandments that He has given me. And I need to be diligent in fulfilling those commandments, doing what He has asked me to do. It says, "And it shall be a tassel for you to look at and remember all the commandments of the Lord, so as to do them and not follow after your own heart and your own eyes, after which you played the harlot." Wonderful, wonderful verse. Not to follow after your own heart. So it's the waverings in your own soul, the changing emotions, that you need to govern those. You need to ride a herd over those. And your own eyes. Your eyes are looking out for things out there, temptations, that would cause you to waver in your commitment and your dedication to God and obedience to God. So these tassels are reminders that the people of Israel are God's people, and to remind them to be obedient to those commandments that God has laid down, and to not waver with respect to their what they're going through, their emotions, and the temptations that are all out there. Okay. By the way, when I was at the convention in Virginia, there was a very interesting talk given by a Messianic Jewish rabbi. And it was the title of the talk was Jesus Through Jewish Eyes. And he goes through the Gospels pointing out various incidents in Jesus' life which have great significance if you understand the Jewish culture and the Jewish background. One of the things that he mentioned is that when the woman who was had trouble with hemorrhaging, I believe that was the illness that she had, wanted to be healed, and she wanted to touch, she knew that she would be healed if she just touched Jesus' robe. That account occurs in three of the Gospels. In two of them, it indicates that she touched the tassels, the fringe. And the word that's used there is the one that's used in the Septuagint in some instances to translate this word tassels. So what she reached out and touched was Jesus' tassels, which I think is quite interesting. Okay, how can this whole chapter be tied together? Is there a thread, a theme that ties these commandments together? Well, there are some sub-themes, I think, that run through this that are important. One is that they all include, in one way or another, a kind of reassurance that they will inherit the land. God is proceeding on the basis, on the assumption, that they will inherit the land. He's making plans for their entry into the land. And when they get into the land, they will become settled farmers. Their life will no longer be nomadic. It will be settled. And they will have plenty, as God had promised. It's a land flowing with milk and honey. Another theme is that the foreign alien who has identified himself with the Israelites, he is a member of the community. He's a full member of the community, has the full rights and the full obligations of that community. And ought to be treated as one of their own. That makes sense. It makes sense to have that emphasis following what had just happened in chapters 13 and 14, because the main advocate for person urging the Israelites to go in and take the land was Caleb. Caleb was not a descendant of Abraham. He was a Gair. He was one who had come to identify himself with the Israelites and had even become a leader within the children of Israel. So he a Gair, was more faithful to God than were the descendants of Abraham. So it makes sense that here we would have that emphasis placed on the significance of the Gair. And then this emphasis that the Israelites need to recognize God as their liberator and as their master. And the burnt offerings and the free will offerings are a means by which that can be expressed, their commitment to God. And the portion of the dough that goes, and the loaf of bread that's given over to God is also that kind of appreciation. And it makes this distinction between willful wrongdoing and unintentional wrongdoing. And clearly, the unintentional wrongdoing is forgivable. It's only the willful rebelliousness that is not forgivable. So I think there are those themes that are running through it. But I think the passage is actually summarized best by the last three verses of the chapter. Even though it's talking about tassels, I think this is really at the heart of what it's talking about in this whole chapter. Because we've seen the people of Israel being freed from Egypt and the slavery there. They make their way through the desert, and throughout that time, even though God is very gracious towards them, you see them constantly wishing they were back, as soon as things are at all uncomfortable, wishing they were back in Egypt. And so what God is calling them to is to take their relationship with God seriously on a day-by-day basis, working at being committed to God who has liberated them from slavery and who deserves to be and is rightfully their master. And just the last, let me read the last three verses again. This is also in the context of the tassel, but I think it really summarizes what he's talking about in the whole chapter. And it shall be a tassel for you to look at and remember all the commandments of the Lord, so as to do them and not follow after your own heart and your own eyes, after which you played the harlot, in order that you may remember to do all my commandments and be holy to your God. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out from the land of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord your God. I know that in later Israelite history, that God, through the prophets, frequently talks about the Israelites as playing the harlot. I didn't realize the extent to which it's right from the beginning that that word is used. There have been several times in Exodus and in Numbers where God refers to the people of Israel as playing the harlot. And that's interesting because it encourages us to think about our relationship with God as being similar to a marriage relationship. And if you think about a marriage relationship is work. It is relatively easy to take the vows at the time of the marriage, but it is another matter on a day-to-day basis to be faithful to that commitment. And anyone who's married, I think, at least going from my experience, knows that emotions kind of come and go. That there are there are really close times in a relationship and there are strained times in a marriage relationship. I think that's probably universal. And there are times when circumstances, even outside the relationship, wear down a marriage. They make it harder. And there are times when there are temptations out there that make the marriage commitment difficult to hold to. But anyone who's really committed to their marriage and wants it to survive knows that it takes day by day work and maintenance. And you have to rein in your emotions. You have to ride herd over them. And you have to be vigilant and on guard against the temptations that are out there. It's a matter of constantly reminding yourself, I made this commitment to this person. This person therefore merits and deserves my faithfulness. And faithfulness is work. It just is. And it's interesting thinking about that with respect to our relationship to God. I think it's similar. That being obedient to God requires constant vigilance, constant maintenance. You have to work on it day by day by day by day and not take it for granted. And the commandments that are given in this chapter, I think, are a step towards that, encouraging the Israelites to see that commitment to God as being one that requires constant vigilance and constant work on a day-by-day basis. There's no way around it. We are fickle beings. We are easily led astray. And that's clearly what we see in Exodus and Numbers in the Israelites. Very easily led astray. It takes work and resolve to keep ourselves reined in and protect ourselves from the struggles that are out there that would tear us away from our commitment. So I think, I mean, it may be stretching it, but I think that's probably the theme that goes through the whole chapter. That God, this is an appropriate time for God to say, you need to be serious about this commitment to me as your God. I saved you. I brought you out of slavery. You are going to be fickle, but you need to rein in your emotions. You need to be vigilant in your day-to-day activities. And the commandments that are given are reminders and helps along those lines. Then in chapter 16 next week, we'll look at an incident in which there is high-handed rebellion. And it is one of the incidents in the 40 years that's preserved in the Old Testament for us to examine. Okay, questions, comments?
First of all, David, thank you very much. That was really good. I appreciated those final comments. This is a general question, and I figured it was as good a time as any to ask it because the subject of this chapter is, at least in part, about sacrifice. I guess I'd always thought that the purpose of the Old Testament sacrifices was as kind of an object lesson. Well, there's a lot of implications. Demonstrating the seriousness of sin, how seriously God takes our sinfulness, that it requires the taking the life of an animal. And also as an object lesson that prepares us to begin to understand the final sacrifice of Jesus on our behalf. So it was interesting to me to start thinking about, well, first of all, it seems like some of the sacrifices, at least, were not in the context of being offered for sin.
Right.
So maybe you could just talk about that for a second. And also, if you would like to offer any comments that you have on the relationship between the Old Testament sacrifices and the sacrifice of Jesus.
Mm-hmm. That is part of what I'm just beginning to work on, and as I begin to work on, begin to realize how big of a question that is. I did not realize how complicated the sacrificial system that the Jews had how complicated that is. And I, too, until I was studying it this week, I didn't realize that the Holocaust, the whole burnt offering, there is shedding of blood, but that's not the emphasis of this particular sacrifice or the free will offering. There are others where that is the emphasis. There are sin offerings where that is the emphasis. It is not the emphasis in this particular kind of sacrifice, but it's interesting that it's there. So my suspicion is that we've got different kinds of sacrifices and offerings that all emphasize a different part of our relationship with God. But there is that huge theme of something having to die because my wickedness is so evil. I think that's a huge theme that runs through these, because it could have been done differently. I mean, there are lots of ways that God could have told the Israelites to express their devotion to him, etc., without blood being shed. So that's clearly an important part of it. But I think all of these sacrifices are emphasizing a slightly different aspect of our relationship with God. And that is not highlighted in the Holocaust offering or the free will offering. Now, as to your other point, it is my assumption that much of the culture that God established for the Israelites ends up being a pictorial presentation of fundamental concepts that then become played out in history in the life of Jesus. And I think that's true of the whole sacramental system, the temple and its furnishings, the clothes that the priests wore. I really think that all of that is very important for understanding the New Testament and what's going on there and the significance of all of that. And I liken it to teaching a young child math. We've always used manipulatives. They can understand addition when you put the marbles out there and you put them into groups and you take some away and put others together. You can visualize what are otherwise very abstract concepts. And I think the culture that God established for the Israelites is kind of like the equivalent of the manipulatives for learning math. It's all of the basic concepts are there that are then drawn upon as history plays its way out.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, David.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fairly new here. Maybe you've addressed this before, but toward the end you were talking about relationship with God and that it takes work.
Mm-hmm.
What does that work look like, would you say?
I would liken it to the work of staying faithful in a marriage. That it's constantly asking yourself, is this relationship important? And the answer, and in a marriage relationship, it is. It is important. Then what makes sense for me to do in order to maintain that relationship? And I think it's the same kind of work with respect to maintaining our relationship with God. Am I committed to the God who is there? And if so, what do I need to do? What does that entail for me? So it's a work of, the way I think of it, it's largely chiropractic on the mind. I mean, it's constantly getting perspective, because our biggest enemy is a loss of perspective. It's seeing the world wrongly. And it's a matter of bringing it back into alignment with reality. And we have to do that constantly. And then our deciding on what actions are consistent with that and doing it. Did I answer?
Yep.
No.
No.
No, this is totally different, less philosophical. In verse 38 when it says, speak to the sons of Israel. Now, I've always assumed that was generic, you know, that it was male and female. But did the females also do the tassel thing?
I don't know. That I don't know. It is interesting that it's my observation that the law is addressed to males throughout. The assumption on the part of Moses when he's giving the law is that it is given to the men. But I think that the assumption behind that is that the men then are obligated to be teachers of their household. But that gives in the law a prominence then to men that is, I think, it's significant. It stands out. It's striking. I don't know whether women wore tassels or not. I would have to look at that. Now it's done. They're on the ends of the prayer shawls, as I understand it. And do women... I don't think women wear the prayer shawls.
This may not be where you want to go today, but this is just a question I have. The priests were put in a position where they were overseeing a lot of sacrifices, but they were also receiving bread and meat. And I'm curious about what sort of accountability they had. And I think corruption could possibly be an issue for a priest because of the role that he has. So that's
right.
Something
right.
Whenever you want to address it.
Right. And that's something that we see. There are a number of instances in the Old Testament where we see that the priests do are corrupted, take advantage of their position. The priests have a special role in Israelite culture. It is, and it's special in that it has, they have unique privileges, but as always seems to be the case, they also have unique responsibilities. And God seems to take corruption on the part of priests particularly seriously. And so the two seem to be in tune.
There are two items in this chapter that I don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
The first is what he means when he says sin,
mm-hmm.
as it seems different than how I understand sin, because I understand sin as to be something like so thoroughly within me that I can quite often not pinpoint where it is,
mm-hmm.
and it also seems to me to be something like a state of my heart. But he talks about sinning unintentionally,
mm-hmm.
and he seems to see it as like specific events.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second item is what taking a vow means.
Let me do the second one first.
Okay.
If you take a vow, I will do such and such. My understanding is that when you fulfill that vow, your vow is, I will, I don't know what would be a good example. I will, I'm trying to think of one that is precedented in the Old Testament. But it will be a promise to God, I will do such and such. And when you fulfill it, then you are obligated to give an offering.
What is that saying?
What is that saying? Why would you do that? I'm not sure. I would assume it's giving thanks to God that you were able to do what you had promised to do. But I don't know specifically. Your other question on sin probably needs a much fuller answer. Here it's disobedience to the law. It seems to be disobedience to the law. And it's not just an act of disobedience, because intention obviously plays a role here, and that's part of what the middle of this chapter is all about. And I think that becomes clearer as you get further into the Old Testament, that intention is absolutely critical to it.
So is the way sin is used here and the way sin is used in the New Testament, is that the same?
Well, I think the notions are not incompatible. But let me defer an answer to this one till next time. Let me think about this. Because I have thought about it some, but I haven't thought about it enough to give a good answer right now. So let me start next week with that. Okay, thank you.